Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Today we're talking to our guest Mark C. Taylor about what it means to be human and our relationship with the world around us. There's a moment early in our guest's book when he writes, "The Anthropocene is over. The question is whether human beings will survive." It's a shocking statement that underscores the urgency with which he wrote and he believes we should read. Anthropocene is the word for our current geological age. It's the period during which human activity is the dominant influence on our environment. It follows the other geological ages, like the Mesozoic and Paleozoic, but it's different from them in that during it, one species, us, humans, Anthropos in Greek, have the power to alter the globe. This has never happened before. Neither dinosaurs, fish, monkeys, nor any other animals have been able to overpower Mother Nature. But human activity, technology, and reproduction have irreparably altered our landscape and climate. The Earth is very different than it was 300,000 years ago when Homo sapiens first appeared. Because of this, we've gotten ourselves into a conundrum. The very changes we have made are endangering us. With the temperature of the Earth rising, our globe is becoming inhospitable, and we're destroying the only home we have. Hence, his warning about the end of the Anthropocene. I don't have to rehearse the science and consequence of global climate change here. Discussion about it is ubiquitous. What concerns me now is what philosophers have to say about it, and more importantly, what foundational questions they want us to ask. The first question is about our behavior. What is the proper relationship between human beings and nature? Many civilizations and religious traditions have viewed it as one of domination. For them, our job as human beings is to extract what resources we could for our own use and bend nature to our will. From the birth of agriculture to the capturing of fossil fuels, human beings have been tasked with removing that which we could never replace, and we have scarred the earth doing so. Of course, there are cultures that have tried to live in harmony with nature, but they've been marginalized for a very long time. The next question is about the future of human evolution. How might we meet change in order to meet the challenges of the future? I don't mean what might we do differently to slow global change, although that is obviously paramount. I mean, what will become of us? Will humans migrate to space or alter our bodies with technology? Will we have nanobots coursing through our veins or upload our consciousness into massive computer networks? As far-fetched as these ideas might sound, there are many people who think some variation of them is likely. They refer to it as transhumanism, the idea that humans will merge with technology and evolve into something more human. This leads to another more basic question, which asks what it means to be human in the first place. In what ways are we different from other biological organisms, and in what ways are we the same? Humans and chimpanzees share 98% of the same DNA, but there are obviously significant differences between the two, not the least of which is advanced human intelligence. In fact, for most of the Western philosophical tradition, it's been the human ability to reason that philosophers used to define the species. Some even went so far as to argue that other animals didn't think at all, although we know better than that now. Yet defining humanity in terms of its reason is a precarious move because no one can agree on what the human mind is. We know what brain is, the matter, chemicals, and electrical charges that exist in our skulls, but we don't know what the mind is. What is consciousness? Where does our sense of self come from? Is there more than one mind or are there many? How can we draw boundaries between minds when the mind itself is a purely abstract, non-physical entity that itself does not take up space? Maybe Buddhism and Hinduism are correct in describing everything as oneness. Today's guest is going to help us sort out these and other questions. He's going to suggest that we radically change our perception of the human place in nature, that we rethink what it means to be separate from the world around us, that we reconsider what the limits of the human mind are, and that we open our imagination to the technical evolution to come. He's going to use science and philosophy to argue that in order to truly understand the human place in the universe, we have to ask how we relate to it. We'll get to what that means later. If he is right, and the Anthropocene is at its end, then we have to change the way we think before we are able to prepare for what is to come. A renewed understanding of what it means to be human is a prerequisite for survival, and there is little that is more important than that. Changing what we know about the world is a daunting task, but that's what philosophy is designed to do. The most foundational questions are also the most difficult, but the rewards for finding their answers are immeasurable. And now our guest. Mark C. Taylor is a professor in the Department of Religion at Columbia University. He's the author of more than 20 books, the most recent of which is After the Human, A Philosophy for the Future. Mark, welcome to Why.
It's a delight to be here with Jack. Appreciate it.
To our listeners, if you'd like to participate, please share your favorite moments from the show and tag us on social networks. Our handle is always at Why Radio Show. Rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or your preferred podcast platform so the others can find the show and listen to all 17 seasons worth of episodes for free, as well as our sister show, Philosophical Currents, at our website, whyradioshow.org. And as always, this show can only happen with your support. We exist solely on listener contributions. So click donate in the upper right-hand corner of our website to make your tax-deductible donation through the University of North Dakota Alumni Foundation portal. So, Mark, I guess I want to start by asking you a very basic question. What do we mean when we use the term anthropocentrism?
Well, anthropocentrism is a philosophical term that I think is inextricably related to this notion of the Anthropocene. As you indicated, I've studied and taught philosophy most of my life. And I don't think philosophy is a discipline separated from the lives of all of us in certain ways. I think we are all implicitly or explicitly philosophical. That is to say, we have philosophical presuppositions and assumptions that inform the ways in which we look at the world and the ways in which we act in the world. And this Anthropocene, which, as you indicated in your good opening remarks, is a unique period in the development of the planet and of the human race, in that human beings are now having a greater impact on the planet than they have ever had before. Underlying that form of life that has led to this impact of human activity on the planet, a certain set of philosophical assumptions and propositions. And those ideas go back, as far as I can understand, to the beginning of modern philosophy. Modern philosophy is often said to begin with René Descartes. Descartes lived during a period when there was considerable turmoil and questioning emerging, partly because what is now regarded as the modern world was beginning to develop. And it was creating all kinds of uncertainties and doubt. And Descartes was plagued by these uncertainties and began to question the world around him. And he finally decided that the best way to try to reach some degree of certainty was paradoxically through doubt. So he decided that what he would do would be to doubt everything that he could imagine until he came to understand the one thing that he could not doubt. And that one thing he could not doubt was himself in the act of doubting. So through doubt, he proves a certain kind of self-certainty that then becomes the basis for his understanding of human being and of its relationship to the world around it. Now, what Descartes then proceeded to argue was that this self-certainty, which involves self-consciousness, was unique to human beings, that everything other than the human mind was a machine. Animals, plants, the world around us, even the human body was a machine, but not human consciousness itself. And that set up a fundamental focus on the human as being different from and separate from the rest of the world, all of so-called nature. Nature worked like a mechanical clock, but not the human mind. That set up two fundamental presuppositions that are, I believe, at the heart of our modern crisis: human exceptionalism and a certain kind of philosophical dualism. Man set against nature, human being set against nature, mind set against body, self set against world, so on and so forth. And what was most concerning to Descartes was somehow to be able to affirm the human, the uniqueness of human being in this machine-like world.
So when I talk about what it means to be an embodied human in the world, sometimes I say to my students, look, as far as you're concerned, you're the center of the universe. Let me prove it to you. And then I stand there and I spin in place and I say, look, the world is around me. I'm in the middle of it. Everything surrounds me. I'm the center. I'm the most important. What's wrong with thinking about human beings as the most important creature, or thinking about us as individuals as the center of the universe?
I would point out that there is, in my judgment, a direct line from this early view of anthropocentrism or human centeredness or human uniqueness all the way down to recent philosophy and a very, very influential philosopher by the name of Martin Heidegger, who wrote some of the most important essays that I know on technology, the dangers of technology. He was not thinking so much of digital technology and network technology that we have now, but still of technology. And he has a phrase that has always stuck in my mind. He said that this whole kind of notion of anthropocentrism or human exceptionalism leads to a situation in which every man, and he uses the term man, because these issues are gendered. You might note that Jack in his introduction referred to Mother Earth. The Earth is seen as mother. Mind is female. The mind tends to be seen as male. So these issues are gendered. Everywhere man turns, he sees only himself. It's a narcissism in all of this. And with this anthropocentrism, this sense of human uniqueness goes, as Jack said, to a sense of human control or mastery over nature. That goes all the way back to the Bible, where God, speaking to Adam, gives him power over all of creation. Right? It follows through the whole Western religious and philosophical tradition in that way. So it issues in what later Nietzsche, and we can talk about him more, calls the will to power. And the will to power is really the control, the will to mastery. And if you want to see the most radical form of the will to mastery today, and perhaps you'll get to this, go to Silicon Valley.
If I understand you right, what you're saying is that by putting the human mind as the only non-machine and making human beings the center of it all, we have created an artificial understanding of humanity's place in nature, and that what you say you want to do in your book is create a radical relationalism. You want to talk about the relationship between human beings and nature as opposed to the competition or the separation of human beings and nature. What do you mean by the relationship with nature, and why is this in opposition to ask about how we relate to things as opposed to how we oppose or compete or are separate from things?
I think the problem is that we see ourselves as apart from nature rather than as a part of nature, as separate from rather than related to. I said in my description of Descartes that two of his fundamental mistakes were human exceptionalism and dualism. That is, that any particular entity, thing, person, whatever, is defined by its opposition to something else. It's man versus woman, man versus nature, the human versus the natural versus the artificial. I think this whole notion of artificiality is itself problematic because it presupposes precisely the kind of opposition that I'm calling into question, the natural versus the artificial. If we are a part of nature rather than apart from nature, then whatever we create is, in a certain sense, natural. That is to say, the machines that we create are as natural as the machines that ants and termites create in order to dwell within them. Right? So we have to stop thinking in terms of these simple oppositions and begin to think about how everything is interconnected. and interrelated. That involves a fundamental shift in the way in which we envision the world, the way in which we envision the world, not only in terms of this history of philosophy that goes back to Descartes and early modernity, but in the rise of modern science, in figures like Isaac Newton, as well as in everyday common sense, where we think of things as separate from each other, different things that are apart from us, chairs, objects, subjects, objects. But they aren't separate. They're all interconnected. And furthermore, and here's the paradox, individuality is not separate from others, things, or persons. It is inextricably interrelated to everything else that is. If we can speak about this in philosophical terms, we talk about ontology, that is, how do we understand being? These are complicated questions. So many of the issues that we're talking about involve terms that we use every day, and we don't even stop to think about it. What do we mean by natural? What do we mean by artificial? What do we mean by intelligence? I taught a course for several years at Columbia that had the same title as this book. And I would begin that course by asking the students, do you think human beings, as we are now constituted, are the last stage in the evolutionary process? Most said no. A few said yes, and that surprised me. But it wasn't because they thought the evolutionary process was going to stop. It was because they thought that human beings were going to go extinct. Now that's sobering, when the best and the brightest are thinking that. And we can say more about that.
You're talking about this idea, this distinction between natural and artificial. And I think about how we think of a beaver's dam as natural and part of them, but the Hoover Dam as artificial and not part of humanity. We think about the technology. Precisely. The objects around us, like our chair, are inseparable from our individuality. I wonder if you could talk about what that means. What does it mean for our chair to be part of us or related to us in that way?
So, again, I have to use some technical terms in all of this. When we try to define any particularity in its individuality, what can we say about it as an individual in and of itself? If I ask you, I'll get to your chair. If I ask you to define Jack's complete uniqueness apart from everything else, what can you say? Now, it seems that that individual uniqueness is the most concrete thing that we can imagine, but it's not, because any characteristic that you give to describe yourself is going to be what? It's going to be the articulation of a difference from someone else or something else. And that difference from is a relationship to something else. So in trying to define your identity as unique, you establish that identity as a difference from a man, a woman, old, young, tall, short, bald, hair, subject, object, self, chair. We have to stop thinking of individuals as separate entities like billiard balls or atoms that are then put together to form a larger whole. And we have to understand them as more like nodes, intersections, in a web that is, in the final analysis, infinite. That is to say, our relationships, our interrelationships, are what make us who we are as individuals. We're parts of wholes that are larger than ourselves. The whole does not exist apart from the parts, and the parts do not exist apart from the whole. They are, and here I'll invoke a term that Jack's already referred to, they're codependent and co-emergent. Everything's connected and interrelated. And if we destroy that which is different from us, we're destroying a part of ourselves.
So part of what makes Jack, Jack is not chair. And that, correct, in order to explain who Jack is, we have to understand what a chair is and what the limits of a chair is and why Jack needs the chair to sit. And so describing Jack is a task in describing not Jackness, but you need all those other things to make that description and make sense. And so you're describing the problem of the one and the many, in that in order to know about one thing, you have to, in some sense, know about everything. You have to, in some sense, know about the whole. And this is one of the greatest philosophical problems in history.
Correct. I mean, one of my guides through this maze and indeed through life is Hegel. And Hegel said, truth is the whole. The other one with whom I've wrestled my whole life is Kierkegaard. And Kierkegaard says, truth is only the individual. Kierkegaard's whole philosophy is an attempt to articulate the unique individuality. And for Kierkegaard, that individuality comes to fullest expression in isolation from everybody else and everything else. That's why the paradigm of individuality for him is Abraham, who, called by this transcendent other dualistic God, leaves his wife and family behind, takes his only son Isaac alone out in the desert to sacrifice in order that he might become himself. But Hegel says, and that would be the most concrete expression of human individuality that Kierkegaard could imagine. But Hegel will say, by contrast, no, Kierkegaard, that isolated individual is completely indeterminate because all of those determinations are a function of his relationships with everything else. The truth of the individual is not the isolated particularity, but the truth of the individual is the whole. And guess what, Soren? You confirm that in your very effort to deny it. When you affirm yourself by negating the other, you are showing that you need the other in order to be yourself. Now, that's complicated, but the implications of that are social, they're economic, they're political, they're ecological, and they're existential.
We have to take a break, and we're going to revisit a lot of this afterwards, but we're going to start talking about the crisis that you described, the climate change, and in particular, death and human extinction. But before that, you're talking to Mark C. Taylor and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
Jack Russell Weinstein. I'm talking with Mark C. Taylor about his book, After the Human, A Philosophy for the Future, and about humanity's place in nature and the future to come. And we're going to talk about the evolution of humanity and the relationship between human and technology shortly. And we're going to continue to talk about this idea of individuality a little bit. But one of the things that you have described to me, and you say it in your book, is that you've had in your career this deep and personal concern about death. What is it about death that you find so interesting, and why is it so central to the project at hand? This is a book that follows a very long career and a lot of writing and a lot of other publications. And you can, when you read it, you can feel yourself reflect on the decades, and you tell all sorts of personal stories and some of your individual history. And at the heart of this is this preoccupation with death. What's that about? Why is death so important, and how does it fit into the picture?
I believe these seemingly very abstract concepts and ideas that the great philosophers and artists and writers deal with are not merely abstractions. I believe they reflect in different ways the very complexities of our human lives. I talk about the people that I write about as my ghosts. They live through me and I live through them. I've always in my teaching and my writing have always been inseparable for me. I try to take these ideas, and they're complicated and they're difficult, and use them as a way to understand the dilemmas that we now are facing. And I want to tell you, these philosophers from a couple of hundred years ago have, at least for me, a lot more to tell us about what's going on in this critically fragile world that we live in than most of the contemporary thinkers that I read. So the liberal arts and the humanities are not luxury items to be dismissed so we can do STEMs that really works. The best scientists and scientists that we have are doing a certain kind of philosophy. They presuppose the philosophy. And even when they don't recognize it, they presuppose it. But the best of them know it. Ideas matter because they change the world. Now, as far as death goes, Martin Heidegger, whom I've already mentioned, is one of the most influential philosophers of the 20th century, one of the three greatest, I think. And in his philosophy, death plays a central role. He argues that human authenticity, in a way very similar to Hegel, can only come through a confrontation with death. That in being toward death, we come to apprehend our own individuality. Because when I try to imagine my death, I become aware of what will not be when I no longer am. Now, Heidegger, though he was a great critic of certain kind of anthropocentrism, still clung to anthropocentrism because he said only human beings can die. Animals expire, but they do not die, because dying, in his sense, presupposes the awareness of death. Now, Heidegger's wrong. He's wrong about animals, he's wrong about a lot, because animals do anticipate death. They can anticipate death. But death, I think, is not, for Heidegger, it individualizes. Biographically, I had a brother and sister I never knew about who died before I was born. I never knew about until I was 12. When I was in the midst of writing this book, and it was paradoxically, when I was writing the very chapter that Jack referred to on the whole problem of consciousness and the relationship of the mind and the body and the role of consciousness in defining who we are or what we are, my sole surviving sibling, my brother, fell into a coma for 3 weeks before he died. We didn't know whether he was aware or not. Question of the mind and body, the question of human uniqueness, gets real when you're in the ICU. And I too have been there. And when you're there, how do we think about that? How do we imagine it? How do we cope with it? I wrote a book called Field Notes from Elsewhere, Reflections on Dying and Living, that reflected on an experience I had that one of my favorite authors, Maurice Blanchot, died without dying, experience that I had. But the preoccupation with death is a result of a concern about life. Life and death are inseparably interrelated. Life has an expiration date. We don't know when that is, and we don't know how it's going to come about. But we all go through that. And I think that the philosophy, the literature, and the art that are most important for me are those forms of expression that help us think about the richness, the complexity, the diversity, the differences of life.
You speak very eloquently of this experience of being in the ICU, and you've mentioned several times this notion of human extinction. Is humanity in the ICU right now? Are we staring at a possible death of our species?
I've tried to explain this notion of the world as an interrelated web or network, Indra's web that the Hindus talk about it as. But these webs and networks have a particular and a peculiar structure, and they work in a particular way. They're what we are called complex adaptive networks. And these complex networks, and I'm not talking about just computer networks now. Yes, I'm talking about that. I'm talking about our biological organism is a network. It's an organism of other organisms. We have to stop thinking about things and people as isolated entities. Everything is interconnected. And what we take to be separate entities are really this kind of fractal set of interrelationships in which everything is in process, everything is in motion, everything is interacting. Bodies are events, and events are interconnected. And when these interconnections become complicated, the nature of the ways in which these systems work changes. They're no longer what we call equilibrium systems, where when things get out of whack, they sort of tip back over and move back toward an equilibrium like a thermostat. No, they're characterized by what we call positive feedback. One thing, what I would want you to understand is this notion of positive feedback. And this notion of positive feedback is related to this notion of interrelationship. We used to think of positive feedback as, you know, getting a good performance review or having good course questionnaires for a class. Now, that's not what I mean. In a certain way, positive feedback's negative. When everything is interconnected in this way, these relationships form these recursive loops in which change becomes faster and faster and faster. Everything sort of keeps speeding up until it reaches what's called the tipping point. The scientists call that the condition of self-organized criticality. It's like a pile of sand, and you keep adding a grain one at a time. At a certain point, you know there's going to be an avalanche, but you don't know which grain of sand is going to do that. And that's the way these events work in social systems, mob rule, in economic systems, in financial bubbles, and in weather systems. Weather systems and financial bubbles work the same way. And in this positive feedback, once you pass that tipping point, you can't reestablish equilibrium. Now, if you understand not just our bodies, but the whole cosmos, earth, air, fire, and water, as interrelated and interconnected, the bandwidth that supports life is incredibly narrow. Drop below 18% oxygen and everything suffocates. Rise above 21% oxygen and everything burns. But this complex adaptive system that we call Earth or our planet has maintained that for millennia. But we're getting close to passing the tipping point. And when atmospheric temperatures, as a result of carbon emissions, take us past that tipping point, life ceases to exist.
So let me see if I can put all of this together. Nature is a system of which human beings are a part. But for many philosophical reasons, not the least of which was Descartes, we made human beings the center of the system. And over time, human beings became more important and more important and more important, and the rest of the system became less important. This became destructive, not only of the physical world, but of our way of perceiving the world to such an extent that now humanity has caused nature to reach a tipping point that maybe we can't get back from. So our problem first is the outcome of a very long period of destruction, and that's why we have climate change and things like that. But it's also the outcome of a very distorted philosophical point of view. So part of what is causing our extinction is the physical reality of nature being distorted and wildfires and carbon monoxide and dioxide and things like that. But part of what is causing our possible extinction is a very destructive and distorted centering of the human experience in what is otherwise a fragile system. So it's a physical and a philosophical problem at the same time.
You're absolutely right. Now, it may be an illusion of somebody who spent his whole life reading, writing, and teaching. But as I said earlier, I do think ideas matter. I don't know whether we have enough time to change ideas. I think we need something like what the early Christians used to call metanoia, a change of consciousness, a change of awareness. To see differently is to be different. The way in which we interpret the world influences the way in which we act in the world, and the way in which we act in the world influences the way in which we see the world. And the problem now, I put this a little bit in a complicated way, but maybe we can understand it now. The urgent problem we have now that is playing itself out day to day to day, and never more so than in the last 2 months, is that we have oppositional ideologies in a relational world. And oppositional ideologies will eventually destroy themselves. They will affirm interrelationships by the effort to negate them. When we cut down all the trees, we die, because the trees are our lungs. And we cannot breathe without the trees breathing with us. Read Richard Powers' great novel, The Overstory. All of that work in The Overstory comes out of the extraordinary research of a woman, and it's important that it is a woman, Suzanne Simard, who wrote a book called Finding the Mother Tree. And what she discovered was that the forest isn't made up of all these separate trees. See all the separate trees and you miss the forest. No, the forest as a whole is a living organism. Forest as a whole is a living organism in which each individual tree can only survive because it's a part of this living organism. And that living organism communicates, and communication is the right word. It communicates through this underground network of fungus. And the trees communicate with each other by emitting certain chemicals that alert them to different coming insects, which allow the trees then to produce something that will, a chemical that will be offensive to the incoming insects. She had a lot of trouble getting her view accepted because the governing ideology or philosophy in biology is Darwin. And Darwin's whole view of the world rests upon what? Competition. And you know where Darwin got that notion of competition? He got it from Adam Smith. And the survival of the fittest becomes that kind of model. Simard's metaphysic, if you will, is cooperation. That's a feminine thing. Competition's a guy thing. That's why she, just like quantum physics, and if we were taking what we're talking about all the way down to the quantum level, atoms aren't little billiard balls. They're complex information systems that are made up of interrelated subatomic particles that are talking to each other in a certain way, that are interacting. That's what it's all made of, these interactions, these interrelationships. Everything is an information process. And our bodies, our minds, our technology are part of this much, much, much larger and more encompassing.
This is the question that I wanted to ask, and it's a very abstract question. So let me set it up. You describe a parallel between human beings and the human mind and these forests. And so a forest is made up of individual trees that communicate with one another and create a whole entity that we call the forest, just like molecules and neurons and all these things communicate. And so the trees release chemicals, just like human beings release dopamine and serotonin and things like that. So there's an analogy, and you're describing there's a mind in the forest, just like there's a mind in the human being. So here's the abstract question. And this is, I think, the core of what you're discussing in the book. Is the forest and the human mind two different minds that are distinct from one another, or is there one central mind that we might call nature that allows humans and trees and other things to communicate and to relate with one another? Are there multiple minds, or is there just one mind and we just need to enlarge our conception of what mind means?
I often say to my students, there's really only one central problem in the whole of modern Western philosophy, maybe more than Western, but that's what I know most about. And that's the problem of the one and the many. How do you get one from many or many from one? There have been all kinds of ways to try to answer, you know, that question. I began this book by talking with a chapter called Elemental. And in that chapter, I looked at the four basic elements, earth, air, fire, and water, and tried to show how each of them is a complex system and their interrelationship, the interrelationships among them is a complex system. But if you go back in Greek philosophy, those were four of the metaphysical systems that different philosophers took each one of these principles to be the foundational principle of everything. Everything was monistic from that point of view, and everything was a part of that in a certain way. So when you ask, are there multiple minds? And we haven't talked about artificial intelligence, which is, you know, so-called artificial intelligence, which is central to all of this as well. Or is it one mind operating through all of it? I want to say in a certain sense, it's both. But I think that the ways in which these codependent and co-emergent and co-adaptive complex networks work, I think the way they operate, again, I'll use a complicated word, is isomorphic across media. That is, they work, they have a structure and operate in the same way wherever they're found. And I think this cosmos that we have is fractal. What is common throughout all of this, it's not any kind of a hegemonic universal network. It's the interacting of all of these networks of networks in that way. So it's a one that's a many and a many that's a one. Again, there's no part whole without the part. There's no part about the whole. But we have all kinds of so-called AIs. You know, it's not just so-called artificial intelligence. I keep saying so-called because I don't think the artificial is artificial, right? It's alien intelligences. It's animal intelligences. It's plant intelligence. It's cellular cognition. And they're all interacting in this way. And rather than trying to, I mean, what human exceptionalism has been freaked out about from the beginning, as I say, is what makes us different first from animals. And that's what Descartes said. We don't want to be animal. We don't want to evolve from apes. We're different from animals. But it's also what is at stake in the whole debates about so-called artificial intelligence. The goal of artificial intelligence forever has been the question of whether we can create a machine intelligence that is indistinguishable from human intelligence. And guess what? ChatGPT comes out, and what happens? Everybody's freaked out because guess what? We might be able not only to create an intelligence as great as ours, but it might even be smarter. And then what if all of these machines got together and created a super intelligence? So then we want to say, no, no, no. We want to distinguish human intelligence from machine intelligence in that way. But if we begin to see ourselves not as separate from all this, and therefore in a certain way, this sense that if our minds are structured like animals or like machines, we're somehow less than human, but rather seeing ourselves as part of this larger planetary, perhaps even cosmic process, it elevates us.
Let's talk about this, because this is where the transhumanist conversation comes in, the discussion about how technology is going to change what it means to be a human being, and this question of artificial intelligence. Because what's scary about the image that you're articulating is the human being in some way is enlarged, as you're suggesting, but in some way begins to feel inconsequential. What makes me special? I'm not special. I'm just another piece of the puzzle. I'm no more important than an individual tree. And then along comes technology, and we get promised all these things from targeted nanobots that can target diseases like in mRNA vaccines, to, and you talk about this in the book, to chips that you can plant in brains so that quadriplegics can control other things, to the possibility, and you don't talk about this, but other people do, of uploading ourselves into the computer. And we start to get afraid that our human separateness disappears inside this large network. I don't think about my glasses, right? I wear my glasses and the world comes in more focus because of it. And so in some sense, I am completely wedded and inseparable from the glasses that I wear, because without them, I can't fully function. Is the new technology going to be like the glasses in that it helps us just function better as individual human beings? Or is the new technology going to subsume us under the network and take away our perception of our specialness and our perception of our individuality?
I love the analogy you use of your glasses, because the man who taught me Kant, and Kant, Immanuel Kant, is at the heart of a lot of what I'm talking about here, said he became a philosopher because at the time he was a child, he wore glasses. I said, "What do you mean, Louis?" He said, "Well, it was clear to me that the world is not as it appears to be." Right? And that was settled. However, right, if we had more time, we could talk more about this, because the analogy of glasses is really interesting if you want to understand quantum mechanics. And quantum mechanics is at the heart of this relational view of the universe that I'm talking about. The great, great contemporary physicist, Italian physicist by the name of Carlo Rovelli, who interprets quantum mechanics and Einstein's relativity theory all in terms of a relationality. That's what I'm getting at. At the quantum level and all the way up, everything's interconnected. Everything, and the word in quantum physics is entangled. The problem isn't that you have a separate object and a separate subject or nature, and how do you get them together? They're never apart. They're always interconnected. They're always intersected. No subject without object. No object without subject. We're interconnected. And furthermore, this notion that all of a sudden we're going to enter the matrix, which is what you're talking about, it's specious. We are already living inside a computer functionally. Back in the 1960s, there was this notion of ubiquitous computing, that the computer is no longer going to be simply this little machine sitting here in front of me, but that it was going to be one big mega computer. Well, guess what? We are now inside that computer. Everything we do, everything move we make, every show we watch, everything we buy, it's programmed. It's recorded. It's data. It's big data. And it's run on these new systems, these neural networks now. And what do? They gather that data, they process it, they create algorithms, and then they use those algorithms to program us. We're being programmed. Again, that's not new. My friend Soren Kierkegaard was the first one to see the implications of this new notion of media or mass media. For him, it was the newspaper or the press. For us, it's the TV, it's the program, it's different news channels and the like. Now, your question, is this going to lead to a repression of our individuality? It depends. And this is at the heart of the political battle now being waged in the Senate, or in the House and Congress, and the President. Because what was supposed to happen with the personal computer, you got to remember that the whole personal computer revolution grew out of the drug culture of the 1960s. It was kids dropping acid around Asbury, Steve Wozniak, Homebrew Computer Club, listening to the Grateful Dead, and creating personal computers. I had graduated from college in 1968. That was the revolution against the system. That was going to, the hegemonic military-industrial complex, going to get rid of that. That was IBM. We're going to put information in the hands of the people, personal computers. That's where the power would be. Lead to greater freedom, greater independence. Create different kinds of financial markets. But guess what we didn't understand? That mass privatization led to a mass collectivization, because somebody else is gathering our data. And the one who has the data has the power. And that power they use to program us. This data is being used to program us, just like advertising in print did before, but now much more in a much more sophisticated way. They're using neuroscience to do this. There's a whole subarea called neuroadvertising, subliminal advertising, they used to call it. But they're using this to program us to want what they want us to want. That's what makes this system go, if you follow that way. That leads, and we do this in information as well as consumer good, that leads to what I call algorithmic authoritarianism. We're being determined by these algorithms. And what's really at the heart, I think, of what's going on in the political revolution right now and why Musk is playing such an important role is that he and Andreessen and Peter Thiel and some of these others in Silicon Valley know that whoever controls AI is going to run the world. If these technologies are monopolized in that way, and if they become mega corporations, they will have the power to have precisely the deleterious effects that you're talking about, Jack. But it doesn't need to be that way. And I think the fear of this kind of super intelligence that you're talking about, that we're creating machines that are going to take over and run us, what they keep forgetting is that those machines that run on information require materials. They require matter. They require energy. They require precious metals. What do you think all this stuff in Ukraine is about with all these precious metals? Each Tesla requires about 130 pounds of lithium. Think about it. And there's not much lithium in the world. There are limits to what these huge computer networks can supply. 3 Mile Island, where there was this huge atomic accident, however many years ago it was, and they shut down all these atomic power plants, is now being revived by Microsoft to provide energy that they need to run their computers. Washington State, a lot of the hydropower is now being drained off to run server farms to supply. At the same time, the governmental policies are undercutting completely environmental protection laws, and that's leading to global drought. You can live without oil, you cannot live without water. All these things are in conflict. An economic system, climate system, and according to this notion of positive feedback, once you pass a critical point, and that's global temperature, you can't get the toothpaste back in the tube. And down that road lies extinction.
So I want to point out what happened because it's tremendously powerful. We went from a very abstract conversation about the nature of individual components in a system, whether it was trees or neurons. And we went from a discussion of 17th century philosophy and Descartes' dualism in mind versus body. We went from these very, very abstract ideas to a very, very concrete political analysis of what's happened in the last week in the news that helped to explain and give meaning to the conflicts that feel like they're about very lowbrow stuff, feel like they're just about immigration and about DEI and about hatred and about getting people angry and things like that. But it's really about the control of the system as a whole and the control of artificial intelligence. And so I guess I want to ask a pushback question, which is to ask, so if that's the case, why isn't the answer to be anti-future? Why isn't the answer to be to resist this kind of technological innovation, to stop funding AI, to push back on privatization, to go back to an older school of government, and to think of ourselves as individual players rather than people in the system. Why don't we save ourselves by trying to destroy the network as opposed to trying to see ourselves as relational and components of that network?
What I've tried to say is you can't get outside of these networks. Set aside the technological, the current form of the technological at the moment. There is no individuality apart from our interconnection with these larger and larger holes. You can't unplug. I also think we've reached a level of complexity in which the hand that inflicts the wound alone can, in a certain sense, provide the cure. The nature and the complexity of the challenges that we face require different deployments of the very technologies that are causing the problem. We've talked a lot about death dealing. We have too narrow a notion of artificial intelligence. Artificial, if we're going to call it artificial, I always put that in scare quotes. If we're going to call it artificial intelligence, that's not just machine learning. I've suffered diabetes half my life. Diabetes is an information processing ailment. It's an anti-immune disease in which the body turns against itself and destroys itself. That's the disease that currently plagues our world. The body politic has turned against itself and is destroying itself. These same technologies of our so-called artificial intelligence are now being used. I mean, if it is the case that cells, that bodies are information processing processes, then it's possible, as we're now doing, to reprogram bodies, to change bodies, to do different things, to create different forms of body. They are now creating so-called artificial, by reprogramming stem cells, they're creating organs that they hope to be able to transplant into human beings. The whole opposition between body and machine is eroding. Machines are biological, and biological organisms are, in a certain sense, machinic. It's a symbiotic relationship. In symbiosis, the two do not simply become one. They enter into a cooperative interrelationship in which each maintains its distinction but changes itself. We're not going to be able to solve these problems with human intelligence alone. We talked about implants a minute ago. Our phones, our computers, our prostheses, we are as much an extension of them as they are of us. We are in a symbiotic relationship with all of these so-called artifacts. You can't unplug. And you can't go back to nature because nature and culture are inseparably interrelated. When the beaver builds that dam, it changes the environment. And if the environment changes, the beaver will change. It's an ecology. The whole network is this complex ecological system. And to unplug from the system is to fall into non-being. The question is whether we can or whether we are able to tweak that system, that network, before it destroys us. And if we're honest and realistic, and we tend to be not to be, it's hard not to despair. And despair is the absence of hope. It's hard to be hopeful. But despair is a self-fulfilling prophecy. When I look at my children, when I look at my grandchildren, when I look at my students, when I look at my friends, even though it seems hopeless, we have to hope in spite of that despair.
Well, this is a hard place to end the conversation, but it's the similar place that you end the book, and it is where we are in the world right now, right? There's no easy answers. There's no oversimplifications, and we're at a point of crisis, and we have to figure out what to do, and that's scary. So I wish that we had more time, and I wish that there were ways to brighten up the discussion, but I guess that's the point. I guess there are moments in history where you just have to face what is in front of you realistically, and philosophy has often been a place where that happens. So, Mark, this has been complex and technical and challenging and abstract, but super interesting. Thank you so much for joining us on Why.
Thank you. It's been delightful. I appreciate it.
You have been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein and Mark C. Taylor on Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, and I'll be back with a few more thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We were talking with Mark C. Taylor about his book, After the Human, Philosophy for the Future. And you know, philosophy's hard, right? And sometimes it's hard because it's inaccessible. And sometimes it's hard because it's just hard, because it asks difficult, complicated, foundational questions that cause us to really challenge our point of view. I'm hoping this conversation was accessible. It could be abstract at the time. It could be technical. We referred to a lot of philosophers by name, which we tend not to do. But I'm hoping that you could get through it as a listener. But if you got through it, then where you are is in a place of crisis. Where you are is a place of recognizing that we are at a fork in history, that if we make the wrong choices, even human extinction is on the table. And that is terrifying. It's beyond terrifying. And I understand why people don't want to think about it, but philosophy forces us to confront the things that we don't want to confront. And one of those confrontations has to be that the way we look at the world is what's causing the destruction, that we think of human beings as separate from nature, that we think of human beings as unconnected individuals, that we think of being special and different as opposed to dependent and interdependent, that we are connected to the forest, literally connected to the forest, because the forest is a living creature and it has a mind and we have a mind and those minds interact. And that puts into question this notion of artificial intelligence. Is a computer intelligence any different than a forest intelligence? Is it any different than the beaver that makes the dam? And because we depend on it and it depends on us, where do we go from here? We are, Mark said, at a moment of despair. But we can also be at a moment of hope. And that is, we can take the reins again and we can rethink our approach to the world and we can try to use the new and advanced technology to promote this interconnectedness as opposed to deny it. And if we do that, then we can take the best of technology and the best of nature and the best of human experience and make the world a better place. If we can't, I'm not sure what else is going to happen. So maybe we have no choice. Maybe we have to change the way we exist in the world, and there's nothing we can do about it. With all of that said, if you've been listening to this episode on Sunday evening on Prairie Public, please know that a longer version with almost 30 more minutes of discussion is available online and as a podcast. Visit Why Radio Show, whyradioshow.org, to listen or subscribe for free. For everyone else, rate us on iTunes and Spotify to help spread the word about the show. Follow us on all the usual social networks. Our handle is always at Why Radio Show, again, WHY Radio Show. And please help us continue broadcasting by making your tax-deductible donation at whyradioshow.org. Click donate in the upper right-hand corner to go to UND Alumni's donation portal. We exist solely on the money you provide. Thank you yet again to Krista Thomason, the folks at Prairie Public, especially our engineer, Tay Colloway. I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, signing off for Why Radio. Thanks for listening. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/MarkWeinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.